now that you've just finished the rehearsal with Max Roach for the upcoming performance of Triptych at Symphony Space, and your association with Max Roach goes back many years. It's been about 20 years since the first performance of the Freedom Now Suite.
Has it been that long? I guess it has.
1960 was when the recording was originally made. And I was wondering how it feels to be working with him
with
again.
Max. It's always an honor and a pleasure to work with him because I get a chance to stretch emotionally and technically in all the ways that you grow as an artist. It's a wonderful time for me. And I'm happy to be back in New York and working with Max Roach.
How long has it been since you worked with him?
About 10 years.
Well, I know that you consider him one of your greatest teachers. What are some of the things that you've learned from him?
Well, many things. I was introduced to the music called jazz through Max. And, you know, the work is a way of life. You learn your skills as a human being, and you learn to apply what you learn in your life in everyday living. It's help. It's a help to character building, this approach to music. And I had an opportunity to work with sort of like a, not sort of, but it was a master apprentice at first. It's the best way to teach the music, I believe. There are so many things to say about the music. The music is, it is our life. It's the expression of the lives that we live. Forever, our lives have been reflected through the music.
Well, this piece in particular, Freedom Now Suite, when it first was performed, when it first was recorded, it was significant in many ways. One in being the first time that, or one of the first times that black artists expressed their feelings about the oppression of their people. And I was wondering if you can recall some of the reactions that
original
reactions.
We did it for the NAACP in Philadelphia, and I think it was in Philadelphia, and when we went into protest, I remember the guards running to the door with their hands to their guns because they thought that something had happened. It's a piece that is emotionally charged, and it takes the audience. Sometimes you hear them answer. It's a very fundamental and elemental approach to the work, improvisational. And it's abstract, too. So, you know, protest was the hardest part for me to learn because I was accustomed to not screaming. And it took longer for me to get that together, the protest part. But it's been very helpful for me as an actor, this exercise that I was introduced to through Max, the triptych. It's a very freeing exercise. And I believe it helped me in many ways, learning to scream.
Right. When you speak of the protest, you're talking about the various segments of this piece with prayer and protest?
Yeah, prayer is the first part, which is preparation for protest. And peace comes out of protest. When you protest and you do all that you can, then there's you feel a feeling of satisfaction, at least. Whether you attained everything that you wanted or not, at least you did express that feeling. And we have performed it in Japan and in Europe, many places. And the response is usually the same. It's a catharsis. for many people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you find that people all over the world can relate to it, and do they go through that entire experience with you?
Yes, because it's a universal peace. Mm-hmm. All people know what prayer is, whether that's the right word for it. It depends upon the language that people, but prayer and protest and peace is a part of our lives.
What was the original inspiration for the creation of this work?
Max Roach, he created the work. He wrote some of the things with Oscar Brown Jr., Jive a Man, Freedom Now Sweet, all of the words are Oscars. Triptych is something that Max heard, and helped me to see. And I was helpful in helping to structure the piece as well.
What I meant was
to express the piece that was structured.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. What I meant was, why did he decide at that particular time that he was going to write a piece like that? Was there anything that occurred?
One of the pieces is called Tears for Johannesburg, when the massacre in 1961, at that time, maybe 1960 or 1961, I thought that the piece was released around 61. Anyway, that was part of the inspiration. The people were going through many things at that time. There was the demonstration at the United Nations, when Patrice Lumumba was killed. And there was a lot of social unrest, and that is the fuel that the artist uses for the fires that we express in the music. The lives that we live and the lives that the people live. And so Triptych, I'm sure, came out of that particular place that he was in at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans for performing it in its entirety again sometime in this area?
I don't know if there are any plans or not. I don't know of them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it will be.
You'd be interested in doing that?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom Now Sweet was really one of the things I remember you telling me before that got you recognition in Japan as far as being considered an artist.
Yes, in Europe and Japan, it was that piece that helped to establish me as a serious singer. And it is a very important piece in the music. Today, it's a hit in Europe and in Japan. And when I was there in January, I'm still working and traveling on the strength of the things that we did in those times. The music is evergreen. I went to Africa and visited for 2 months with Miriam McCabe. She took me on a holiday. And I got another name, Aminata Moseka. And I heard a lot of music when I was there. I didn't take a camera. I took myself, and when I came back to New York, I heard People in Me and Caged Bird, a collection of songs. I went to Japan later, maybe a couple of months later, and had the opportunity to record
mm-hmm.
with Al Foster on drums, Tume, Dave Liebman, and Inaba, a great bassist from Japan, and a Suzuki piano player.
Mm-hmm.
From 12 o'clock midnight until 6 o'clock the next morning, we made this album with the help of Miles Davis, who lent me his musicians, and Tume, Al Foster, and Dave Liebman.
Mm-hmm.
And the album is doing well, and I've been on the road since, touring with the Abbey Lincoln Quartet
mm-hmm.
since its release with Inner City. When I was in Paris in January, I recorded another time with Archie Shepp, an album called Painted Lady, three originals that I have written. and a Duke Ellington and a Stevie Wonder tune. Mm-hmm.
What is that available in this country at all?
It will be later on, probably in the fall.
Do you know what label?
I don't want to say whose label it is, but I'm talking to somebody about. Mm-hmm. We have a deal, I think, mm-hmm. to release it here as soon as things can be finalized. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking back to some of the people that you originally worked with, even on the Freedom Now suite, people like Coleman Hawkins, who was one of your earlier influences.
Yes. I heard Coleman Hawkins the same time I heard Billie Holiday in Calvin Center, Michigan, in the country. My sister brought some recordings home. And when I had a chance to meet Coleman Hawkins and to work with him, it was a great thrill in my life. He reminded me a lot of my father, just in his way, in his bearing. I think if my father had been a musician, he might have been a man similar to Coleman Hawkins.
Mm-hmm. Well, you once also told me that you believe everything is in a name, and you have had many names during your lifetime. Your album is called People in Me, and I wanted to find out about some of the people in you. Starting with your family background, you were born in Chicago, isn't that right?
Yes.
Raised in the country, in Michigan.
I was born to the name Anna Marie Wooldridge. And then in 1955, I took the name Gabby Lee and worked for a year. And then I became Abby Lincoln in 1956. And Amanata was given to me in 1973, at the beginning of the year. Yes, names, you know, working as an actor, I am able to see a little clearer now what names mean. When you write a play, you name your characters. You name the play and you name your characters. And the action for the character is also in the name. I've learned to go to the dictionary when I accept a part and find out what the meaning of the name is that the character has. So, all of the names that I have had have all been positive and wonderful names. Amanata Moseka is an addition in recognition of my African ancestry. And they are, both of them are gods. Amanata is the female of Amin. Amin is the name that is Amun, Amen. It's the last part of Tutankhamun's name. It's an ancient African name. The great hidden god. And Moseka is a god of love in the form of a maiden. Mm-hmm. So, they are spiritual names that I treasure.
Well, these names were given to you by some very special people.
That's true.
Amanata by the president of Guinea, isn't
it? Sekou Touré. And Moseka was given to me by the Minister of Information in Zaire. Mm-hmm. He's probably not the minister anymore. Mr. Sakombe.
In your travels through the countries in Africa, what was the thing that most impressed you?
That I hadn't really gone anywhere, that we as a people have not really gone anywhere. Nothing much has changed. The mixing of the blood and the transplanting of the people from one continent to the other, we still look like our ancestors, and we have the ways of our ancestors. I felt at home when I got to Africa. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel estranged or peculiar. The Africans didn't know what nation I represented. That was the thing, because I had my hair in braids and I wore some African dresses that were not particular to any place. But I see myself as Pan-African, you know. Pan-world, really, but especially Pan-African. Mm-hmm. And so I don't try to dress for any particular country. I feel that I'm the new Africa, the new growth. Mm-hmm. And I was treated with great respect and interest. And I enjoyed myself a lot. I look forward to going back again.
Mm-hmm. While you were over there, that particular trip, you didn't perform at all?
No, I was a companion to Miriam. Mm-hmm. And I had a chance to visit the heads of states and to see life on that level. It was interesting.
Did you feel that your background in growing up in the country helped you at all with your music? How does that affect your approach to the music?
I grew up in silence. We didn't have a radio because my people were not farmers originally, but anyway, for some reason, we never afforded a radio. There was a piano at home and a Victrola, and I played the records that my father brought from the homes that he worked in. They weren't indigenous songs. They weren't songs that I had that were indigenous to my people, but it was music. I would lay on the grass and watch the clouds roll by, so I learned the state of meditation early in my life. And I planted with my people in the spring, and I know that what you put in the ground, you gather in the fall. If you plant tomatoes, that's what you'll get. If you plant corn, you'll get that too. And I watched the animals cohabitate and reproduce. I think that the country is a good place for the human being as a reference. The folks who live in the cities need to go to the country and live a while and then come back maybe to the cities. Mm-hmm. But I believe that country life is a good life for people, mm-hmm. no matter what field you decide to go into. I learned from my mother and father creativity. They always look to the land and to themselves. We didn't depend upon doctors or teachers. I learned to play the piano. I taught myself to play the piano, the little that I learned to play. It was enough to play for Sunday school and church, you know, and to entertain myself. I know that everything that I am today is the result of what my people are and the people who surrounded me and who helped me to be my mother, my father, my sisters and brothers, and the people that I meet every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of your brothers in particular encouraged you, did he not?
Yeah, Melvin. When I was about 4, going on 5, I don't remember much. Some people remember particular things at that time, but this is one thing I do remember. We were visiting some neighbors, and he was bragging to his friend about his age, Alvin, that I could play the piano, and I was there to listen. And Alvin said to him, "Oh, you're lying, because she's too small. She can't play the piano." He said, "Oh, no, she really does. She picks out melodies on the piano." I don't remember doing that before he told me that, well, that was what I was doing. But after that, that was the kind of encouragement that I got. We reflect one another, you know, our lives. And the encouragement that you get as a child, if somebody had told me that I was rotten on the piano and not to play it, I wouldn't have played. If it had gotten on my mother's nerves one time, I'm shy in many ways. I know I would never have bothered the piano again. She didn't tell me to play it, and she didn't tell me not to play it, but they didn't bother me. That's the way I grew up, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. encouraged to be myself without really being told what to be.
Did you always sing? Did that come very naturally to you?
I sang the songs that I heard in church, hymns. It wasn't until I got to high school that I heard songs that Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and people like that were singing. Mm-hmm. On the Band Follies in Kalamazoo, I sang A Sunday Kind of Love and Stormy Weather. And Don't Blame Me, the last year was mm-hmm. the last one. I listened to Sarah Vaughan, Ella, Billy, Lena. Those are my influences. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about Billie Holiday, your impressions of her? You said it was a thrill for you to meet her.
Yes, when I heard her on record, I don't know how to explain what it was I felt. I had never heard body and soul in connection with anything other than a religious approach when I heard Coleman Hawkins' Body and Soul. And when I met her in Honolulu, Billie Holiday. I was working there, and my name was Anna Marie, and she was working at the Brown Derby. She came to see me a couple of times at the Trade Winds. I was working at the Trade Winds. And I would do my show and then run over to the Brown Derby to catch her show. And I remember her looking like a little delicate flower, and with her arms kind of raised, but not, she didn't move much, and her eyes would slide from one side to the other, and I thought, wow, that's what I want to do. And then, well, that was encouragement. The fact that she came to the club where I was working to, you know, just and sat at the bar. I remember twice that she came. That was fine. She, you know, one time would have been enough. Mm-hmm. She came twice. And then I met her in New York when I came here in 1957, 58, 59. And I hung with Maley and Bill Dufty, Bill Dufty who wrote her story. So I had a chance to see her, but I was always afraid to say anything. I didn't know what to say to her. She's always been somebody special. Mm-hmm. She has a great influence, though. She did, and still has on my life.
Well, did you ever study music?
Mm-hmm. I studied it all my life. Whether there was somebody else to study with me or to teach me or not. Yes, I've always studied music. I am not a theoretical musician. Mm-hmm. I failed music in school, and I failed art in school, and I failed home economics in school. But the only thing I was good in was English. But I've been making my clothes, designing my clothes since I was around 14. And singing and playing the piano and expressing myself, you know, all my life.
Mm-hmm. How did your career as an actor get started?
It was as a result of my singing career. It used to be that when people looked for somebody to do a movie, they looked for the singers because nobody could hang as an actress long enough to be called an actress. Mm-hmm. Now there are many women on the stage who are actresses. That's what they do. But when I made Nothing But a Man, I was in Miami Beach working at the Playboy Club. And the producer sent for me as a result of Chuck Gordone, who recommended me for the role, or sent me the script and asked me if I'd be interested. And when I made For Love of Ivy, it was the same thing. I was working in Pittsburgh with Max at Crawford's Grill. Mm-hmm. And they were testing everybody, and the role was mine. Some roles are mine and some are not, like it for everybody. Those that come easy, I'm thankful for, and I like to do them. If it's difficult, I'd rather not be involved. Mm-hmm. I don't pursue an acting career.
Mm-hmm. People come to you.
It's better that way.
Mm-hmm.
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 Yes.
Well, the film Nothing But a Man is a film that is really still shown quite often. It's a classic
Kind of film. So is For Love of Ivy.
Yes.
I'm happy about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The first film that you actually made, though, was
The Girl Can't Help
It. The Girl Can't Help It.
With Jane Mansfield. I didn't even know what the film was about. I was a part of that film as a result of my manager, Bob Russell, who named me Abby Lincoln, who wrote the lyrics, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and Crazy He Calls Me, and You Are My Thrill, a great lyricist. He named me Abby Lincoln, and he was a friend to Lionel Newman, who was the musical director of the film. And so I was sent for, and the wardrobe master put me in this dress that Marilyn Monroe wore in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes or something like that. And I used it for a crutch for a little while. And it was nearly my undoing because I got a reputation for being something that I didn't like the thought of being. Mm-hmm. Insincere. But when I met Max, he saved my life, you know, really, in more ways than one.
You had that dress on when you
met
him?
When I first met him, I didn't. My name was Anna Marie. And he'd heard me sing in Los Angeles, and he encouraged me, told me that he thought I was very talented. And when I heard him play the drum, I'd never heard anybody approach an instrument like that before. He was with Clifford Brown at that time. He was just forming that group, Clifford Brown and Richie Powell.
George Morrow.
And I didn't see him for a while. Between that time and the next time I had seen him, my name had been changed to Abby Lincoln, and I had learned this new approach. I had a press agent, and I was becoming very well known, but I didn't know how to do anything yet. And I knew it, too, you know. And it frightened me, and I was beginning to be unhappy with my life. And I saw him again at Smalls. He was working there with Kenny Dorham and Sonny Rollins. The association really dates from then. That's when he kind of just took me under his arm and said, you don't have to do that. And told me what things I could do. Mm-hmm. He's a great teacher. Mm-hmm. He has been instrumental in many people's lives. Many musicians I have seen come through. Because he always did look for new talent. Booker Little. And Julian Priester, and many mm-hmm. Musicians. Mm-hmm.
Right. It makes me, when you mention Booker Little and Julian Priester, I think of Eric Dolphy and
yes.
That other very classic recording that you made straight ahead.
Mm-hmm.
What are your recollections of that session?
Well, here again, Max was the producer, really, in that he put the thing together mm-hmm. and conceived it. I wrote, that was my first time to write most of the songs. I was becoming proficient as a writer. And I was in school, though. And a lot of the things that I sang at that time, I was going on faith. For instance, In the Red. It's a Max Roach composition that the trumpet player we were just talking about.
Booker
wrote the arrangement for. And when I got finished with the recording, I mean, when we finally got a take on it, which was only one, I was shaking because I didn't know where the notes were. I had to feel my way all the way through. So I think I have always been open for experiment as regards the music. I've been willing to experiment, and maybe was one of the things that made me, that endeared me to some of the musicians, was that I was, I didn't mind taking a chance.